From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this segment was made on August 3rd in the Buffalo News. A letter to the public from rock star Jon Bon Jovi was published in the singer's effort to win over the public. He wants to be part of a group that purchases the Buffalo Bills, but that letter really did the opposite of what it was intended to do. It sparked a backlash. The lieutenant governor even joked that Bon Jovi would be banned in New York State. No one seemed to trust him. Fans worried that Bon Jovi's group would move the team. Well, that's where the Buffalo Bills Fan Alliance comes in. It's a group that's aiming to make sure that whoever buys the Bills keeps them in Western New York. Now, over the last few months, a lot of listeners of this program have asked, is there any chance for Buffalo to enact a kind of Green Bay model, a kind of public ownership? And the answer in technical terms is no, but the Fan Alliance is trying to do whatever they can to keep the public actively involved beyond just a rooting interest here. So we have a couple of guests who are going to help us understand the very latest of what's going on and what the public can do going forward. Brian Sinelli is on the line with us. He's in Buffalo, and he is the co-director of the Buffalo Fan Alliance. Brian, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Greg Hanlon is also on the line. Greg is a journalist, a sports journalist, and his piece on July 30th, called Home Sweet Home in Sports on Earth, is one that really fully encapsulates the Buffalo Bills story and their efforts to maintain a team in that area in Buffalo. And Greg's on the line with us as well. Greg, nice to talk to you.
Evan, thanks for having me.
Let me start with Brian. I'm going to start with just a basic definition and explanation. Brian, when was the Buffalo Fan Alliance born and why?
The Buffalo Fan Alliance came together about 3 years ago now at this point in time. It was a group of three directors, at least initially. It has grown exponentially since then. But the three of us came together about 3 years ago to explore some options that we could do as fans and as a community to protect the future viability and existence of the team here in Western New York, and we analyzed a bunch of options, both proactive and reactive options that we could do to try to protect their existence here, and quickly focused on one proactive funding mechanism.
And Brian, I mentioned already, and I'm sure you've heard many times over the years, people want to know, can we be the next Green Bay? The NFL is not going to go in that direction for a lot of different reasons, but give me a sense for what the Fan Alliance thinks is possible when it comes to public involvement.
Sure, yeah. I mean, for a number of reasons, we can't be the new Green Bay in the sense that we can't own equity shares of the team. For disclosure reasons and some other reasons, the NFL simply is not going to open that door back up. But what we quickly focused on was a financing mechanism that didn't involve equity share of the team, but did involve coming together and starting a fund, donating to a fund that could lend its resources to an ownership group or stadium group at 0% interest, amortized over a long period of time, in exchange for securing some ironclad and very protective relocation agreements that would protect the future of the team here for generations to come.
Okay, and I want to talk about how that would work. Essentially, have you set a target number to raise, and where does the money go? How far along are you, et cetera?
Sure. We early on, probably about 2 years ago, we commissioned a site selection firm out of Dallas to run some demographic studies and projections for us. Their initial projections, which we still feel comfortable with, had a range estimating that we could raise anywhere from $100 million to $170 million, essentially. We have been working with a number of law firms over and accounting firms over the course of the last couple of years. We have a national law firm with transactional experience who has kind of been guiding us since the inception of this project. With Mr. Wilson's passing and some of the accelerated timetables, more recently we've also just added Damon and Morey and Lippis Mathias, which are two well-known and well-regarded transactional firms here in Western New York. We also have Tronconi and Segura, which is a large accounting firm here in Western New York as well. So they are in the process of doing all the regulatory filings and working with the various agencies to ensure that those filings are completed and approved. Our projections are anywhere from 100 to 170 million, and the filings are in the process now. I don't have a firm date as to when those will all be approved. A lot of that will depend on the back and forth with the government agencies.
Okay. So now we're getting a sense for what the Fan Alliance wants to do. Let me ask Greg Hanlon. Again, Greg's piece called Home Sweet Home in Sports on Earth online is worth looking up, and if you haven't read it, it's a long read and worth every word of it. Greg, you start out by saying, the history of Buffalo and its Bills is a story of loss, the loss of over half the population from what was once the eighth largest city in the United States, the loss of much of the industry that once employed that population, the loss of four straight Super Bowls in the 1990s, the loss of so many games since then that the Bills haven't made the playoffs in 14 years, and the latest loss was the Bills' founding owner, Ralph Wilson, who died last March at 95. But then you kind of turn around and say, it'd be easy to start with that premise and say, losing population, losing industry, et cetera, and now potentially losing a franchise. But a lot of the piece that you wrote gives the sense that the public perception, at least outside of Western New York, about Buffalo as a sad sack region that shouldn't have a team, might be wrong. Tell me about the way you put this piece together and some of the conclusions.
As I researched this piece, one of the first things I learned was how many fans the Bills draw from outside of the immediate Buffalo-Niagara region. If you look at the Buffalo-Niagara metropolitan area and strictly define it on those terms, it's the second smallest market in the NFL and the 50th largest metropolitan in the country. And from that, you know, just on the face of that, you would think, oh, this area has no business owning having an NFL team. But the fact is that the Bills draw one-third of their game day fans from a broader region, which includes Rochester and includes southern Ontario. Now, if you put those areas and together with the Buffalo-Niagara region, you're looking at, you know, sort of a mid-sized market, which goes a long way towards explaining why the Bills earn more revenue than 10 other NFL teams. So, you know, kind of the trite narrative about, oh, like, poor Buffalo, it's, you know, it's past its prime, it's dying, it's decaying. If you look at, look closer at the actual facts, it doesn't really match that. Another thing, and this was in the news several months ago, from 2012 to 2013, which was the last count, the Buffalo Metro actually gained population. Now, this is an area that's been losing population for 50 years, and optimists believe that, you know, it's primed for a turnaround. There's a lot of conditions that, you know, lend themselves to cities with old architectural bones, with a manufacturing base, with a, you know, authentic sense of community, with a strong educational base, you know, rebounding. And a lot of people think that we're kind of in the beginning stages of a pendulum swing with those types of places being revalued. And it doesn't seem like much. Buffalo, the Metro gained about 350 people during that period, but if you're inclined to be optimistic, and Buffalonians are certainly inclined to be optimistic, then that's at least a start, and, you know, kind of, you know, belies that narrative about, you know, the shrinking region, the inexorable death of the region. Buffalonians don't see it that way, and the Bills have kind of become a linchpin, you know, for that, or have become a focal point for that struggle to say, hey, you know, this region isn't dead yet, and, you know, the narrative that we don't deserve an NFL team, that's not true.
And you also, I think, astutely, you turn to Bruce Katz, the founding director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, where he talks about the fact that if all you celebrate, all you look at is consumption and home building, sure, the warm climate cities, the Las Vegases of the world, are kind of on the rise. But Here's a quote from Greg's piece from Bruce Katz. Quote, but in a world where we revalue manufacturing and research at universities and authentic community, Buffalo begins to look a lot better. He cites assets that are hidden in plain sight, among them architectural bones, proximity to the United States' largest trading partner in Canada, and a base of industrial expertise. In other words, a city that could in many ways look at the Pittsburghs of the world and revive. And here's what's very interesting to me. You've got Brian Sinelli on the line with us from the Buffalo Bills Fan Alliance, and Greg Hanlon points out in the piece that if the narrative about Buffalo really were true, then Brian Sinelli and Matt Sabuda, who are 30-somethings who are helping drive this effort to keep the Bills, they'd be out of here. I mean, Brian, if Buffalo really were a place with no future, I assume you'd be living somewhere else, as Greg points out. Is that true?
Yeah, in fact, I'll do you one better. I went to school in D.C., started my career in New York City, and made the conscious decision to return to the area for all the reasons that Greg mentioned and ones that I became familiar with growing up. So we share Greg's optimism. There is a lot going on here, both in terms of the medical campus and the waterfront and a lot of other projects and investment going on in the region right now. And I think our generation, Matt and I, as well as others our age, kind of share a different view of Buffalo and a different view on its emergence again. Thankfully, we weren't part of the days where, you know, Buffalo Hems feel closed. I mean, we all sympathize with that and recognize the impact on that, but we're not haunted by that. We see a new generation, we see new investment, and we see new opportunities in the region. We're excited about that, and that's part of the reason that our effort came together. Why can't something innovative come out of Buffalo? Our group has among it four Hall of Famers, many ex-players, many business leaders in Rochester, Southern Ontario, in Buffalo, and all of us share a similar optimism for the region and for our project specifically.
We have a note, a rather lengthy email from Travis, who is a Bills fan, who has, I'm going to try to summarize here, and maybe Brian can help us with this. He's asking a number of questions. Number one, he wants to know how fans in Rochester like him can contribute to the Fan Alliance Fund. He wants to know if the NFL is taking note of it, and is this being part of the discussions about the next ownership group, and if this money is used, $100 million or more, tell us again exactly how it would benefit Buffalo fans. So there's a lot to digest there, so let me go one by one. Brian, Travis's first question, if fans in Rochester want to get involved with the Fan Alliance, what do they do?
Well, they can get information on our ongoing efforts from our website, buffalofanalliance.org. In terms of monetary donations, our fund is not up and running yet. As I mentioned before, we're still waiting from IRS
yep.
and some other regulatory agency approval. But once that is up and running, we'd be happy to have their donations, and we expect to come out with some announcements soon on the progress of that.
It's very hard to raise money for a lot of causes, even from passionate people. And you're putting numbers, $100 million, $170 million. I mean, that is a huge number, isn't it?
It is. But again, the demographic study kind of supports that. And beyond that, we've had a survey that's been linked to our website for some months now. And we've had well over 1,000 completed responses from people who leave their contact information that gave us a lot of feedback in terms of price points and levels of support. And by all accounts, those numbers seem to be supported by the survey results as well. Because you have to remember, one thing that, you know, we're constantly bombarded at is that, you know, there's a brain drain from the region, and, you know, everyone has been leaving the region except for recently. But what the beauty of our fund is that that actually becomes a strength for fundraising efforts. The Buffalo Bills have the largest Bills backer chapter of any team in the NFL. They have a huge fan base outside the region, and our fund would seek to solicit donations from all these expats across the country who look to the Bills and the Sabres as their glue back to their region, as their tie to their communal beginnings, and seek to have their support. So while the numbers may be a bit jarring initially, I think they're well supported.
Talking to Brian Sinelli, an attorney in Buffalo and the co-director of the Buffalo Fan Alliance that is aiming to keep the Bills here. Travis also wanted to know if you've gotten any indication from the NFL, Brian, that they are watching what you're doing and that it matters and that they're aware that maybe that there will be a chunk of money in play designed to influence the proceedings, or are they sort of keeping behind closed doors and doing their own thing apart from what you're doing?
Yeah, we've had some informal feedback that they are aware of the efforts. I'm not sure we'll ever get a formal overt endorsement from the league, although, you know, I'm not closing the door on that possibility. But all the feedback that we've gotten from our national law firm with NFL transactional experience, one of the reasons that piqued their interest in our fund was that this model could be replicated across other NFL cities. The NFL is desperately looking for a way to monetize fan support short of selling equity shares, and our model represents a way for them to do that. So the feedback we've gotten has been informal, but I think it's one that's been positive as well.
In a minute, I'm going to let Greg go so we can open up the phones, but let me close by asking with Greg Hanlon, a sports journalist and whose piece appeared in Sports on Earth, taking a broad look at Buffalo and the efforts to keep the franchise here. Greg, I want to just ask you about one specific part of what you wrote about, which is that you've touched on it already, just how viable Buffalo is as an NFL city and how much we ought to consider the market. You looked at Buffalo. You looked at where the fans come from for the games, for the merchandise, for the interest in the team, etc. If you looked at the other NFL franchises, would they also have large regional imprints as well? And is it fair to look at Buffalo as a broader sort of regional market, you know, while we may look at other NFL cities as more municipal?
Right. Well, I think the telling statistic there is that the revenues generated by the Bills were better than 10 other teams, which just sort of doesn't match the off-site statistic of Buffalo being the second smallest market, bigger than only Green Bay, which is kind of a one-off, you know, it gets kind of a grandfather, you know, exemption, for being a unique thing. So, you know, that statistic is wielded like a cudgel and held against Buffalo. But I think the relevant statistic is, you know, their revenue is right in line with the sustainable NFL team. And given that, sort of all the talk about, you know, this region can't support a team, it seems to stem from this, you know, kind of popular perception of Buffalo as this sad sack place. And as a county executive, Mark Poloncarz pointed out to me, he said, look, there are three teams in the NFL that are currently on one-year leases, the Rams, the Raiders, and the Chargers. They're on one-year leases with their stadiums. Why isn't anybody talking about them as candidate? You know, why is all this about, you know, the Bills are going to move, the Bills are going to move? And, you know, I think the reason is that it just sort of dovetails with our popular notions of post-industrial cities and decaying places, and you know, and I think that's not fair, and I think you know, the future in Buffalo will bear that out.
Greg, it was great work from you in Sports on Earth as usual. It's always nice to catch up with journalists who are doing long form. It's nice to see that occasionally long form still has a venue, and I hope that continues online. Where can we find more of your work?
So in the future, I'll be doing some stuff for Sports Illustrated. I'll also be continuing to do some stuff for Sports on Earth. Medium's The Cauldron sports website, I'll be writing about football for them. So, you know, onward, and it's an unpredictable world with online, you know, long-form journalism, but, you know, there are opportunities out there. So, you know, onward for me, onward for Buffalo.
There you go. Greg Hanlon, writer who wrote the piece for Sports on Earth. Thanks for the time, Greg. We'll let him go now, and we'll open up the phone lines. If you want to call and join the conversation for a few more minutes on this subject, a question for Brian Sinelli with the Buffalo Bills Fan Alliance, you can do that. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI. 563-9994. Brian, would you trust Jon Bon Jovi as far as you could throw him or not?
No, I mean, I think our group's position on his representations to date have been well stated. You know, our group has received a lot of press, both in our initial reaction to his open letter to the Buffalo News, and then when we came forth with some regulatory filings in press clippings that we found independently and released to the press just recently.
We're talking to Brian Cinelli about, from the Buffalo Bills Fan Alliance, about possible ownership groups now, and Jim Kelly's name came up as a kind of a floated as an option to align with Jon Bon Jovi, and Tim Graham and others in the Buffalo News have reported that that's kind of not happening. And it looks to me, Brian, like if nothing changes, it would be hard to see anybody else but Terry Pegula and his wife getting the team. But is that getting too far ahead of ourselves? I mean, is that the best-case scenario? Is that what you expect to happen? What do you think?
I mean, certainly all our indications so far is that he is probably the leading contender. I think, you know, what our group fears is the people that you don't hear about. You know, the numbers have been reported all over the place, you know, from 60 to a lot less that signed the initial NDA to get the initial financials. And the numbers are also not certain as to who remains in the second phase of the due diligence process. So while all public accounts point to Mr. Pegula, you know, I think it's putting the cart before the horse a little bit to announce a winner yet.
What is there? Is there a number? Is there a $1 billion? Is it $1.4, $1.5 billion? Are you concerned that an outside group from another city would come in with a staggeringly high number that could sway the NFL? I mean, give me a sense for what you think the landscape looks like in terms of the bids.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is everyone's fear, is that an outside group with intentions on moving the team makes a bid that just blows everyone else out of the water. I think we have a couple things going for us, though. You know, it remains to be seen whether Mr. Wilson put any provisions in the trust instrument that would give any type of priority to local ownership interests. And then you also have to remember that there's a second approval body here, and that's the NFL owners. And we would hope that the support and history of this region and this fan base would cause the NFL owners to have some pause before they agreed to approve an outside ownership group. The third thing that we have in our favor is the great job that the county executive and governor did in negotiating the current lease and the non-relocation agreement. I think that's another wonderful protection that I think has dissuade a lot of outside investors from even getting involved in the process.
On Twitter, Beth writes that I appreciate the effort to keep the Bills, but aren't taxpayers going to have to pay enough in terms of a new stadium that could cost us $1 billion? Why should we donate to a fan alliance when we're already going to be hit with more tax dollars if the team stays? How would you answer that, Brian?
Well, first thing, I think he's right. I think based on the timetable now, the focus has shifted more towards a stadium funding concept, and that's for a variety of reasons. But in answer to his other part of that, you know, as I indicated before, you know, governmental subsidies in this day and age are not a given. I think there'll be a lot of back and forth between the team, the league, and the governmental entities as to the amount of the subsidies placed on the taxpayers. But more importantly, I think our concept presents a way that people can voluntarily donate to this cause. And more importantly, it's going to include a large component of people who live outside the tax base. So this will be people who live outside the regions who aren't being taxed that will voluntarily donate their money to protect the future of the team and the place that they once lived and grew up.
Should the taxpayers be willing to to front the bill for a new billion-dollar stadium. And again, I know you're saying that we don't know the formula for funding it yet, but historically we've seen taxpayers have to pick up quite a lot when it comes to new stadiums. What do you want to see fans willing to do? As a fan, what are you willing to see happen?
I mean, I think the trend in governmental subsidies has increased tremendously from you know, where the stadiums were even 10 years ago. There's no question that governmental subsidies for stadium projects have been shrinking. That is in part one of the reasons the league came out with its loan program to fund some of the stadiums. I think our plan presents a way that would further decrease the burden on the taxpayers, in that it would take voluntary contributions from members of the community and those who lived abroad that wanted to voluntarily donate to the fund. And one thing that I forgot to mention previously about the fund is that the money will be repaid back by the team. It'll be amortized over a longer period of time, but it will be repaid back to the fund once those monies are repaid to the fund.
It's a loan, right? It's a loan?
It's a loan, yep. So once those monies are repaid back, they can be relent to the team to service other debt costs, or if the team doesn't want to take advantage of that loan program again, all those monies will be disseminated to local Western New York charities in Buffalo, Rochester, and Southern Ontario.
We're talking to Brian Sinelli, an attorney in Buffalo who is the co-director of the Buffalo Fan Alliance, and they will soon be trying to raise $100 million or more to use as a kind of loan for the next Buffalo Bills owner, as a kind of insurance to make sure the team stays. Paul writes to us and says, I doubt the NFL would allow a fan group to give a new owner $100 million because wouldn't that make it, what is here? Let me back up here. Let me make sure I'm reading this correctly. Because wouldn't that make it like Green Bay? Wouldn't that make Buffalo like the next Green Bay, and the fans would have essentially a stake in the team? Why would the league allow that? Brian?
No, I mean, that is the focus of our group, and the real difference between us and the Green Bay model. In Green Bay, they sell equity shares of the team. So although the shares are non-transferable and, you know, essentially have no worth, they sell shares of the team to fans and people who want to buy them. Here, we're not selling equity shares in the Buffalo Bills. We are donating to a fund that is going to lend money to the team. So there'll be no ownership interest. There'll be no disclosure obligations that'll be triggered. So it won't cause red flags at the league level for any of the reasons that the Green Bay model does. So we're essentially polar opposite almost of the Green Bay model.
Okay, and some good questions here from listeners, and you're hearing some good clarification from Brian. A couple more before we let you go here. Remind our listeners who might be just tuning in, you can't start collecting those donations yet, but you're going to be under a bit of a tight deadline if the league does move forward with an ownership change in Buffalo or a new ownership selection in Buffalo. We're hearing a lot about owners' meetings in October. That could be the time when the league makes a final decision. So give me a sense for how tight of a timeline you think you're on to raise money.
Well, we've spoken with a number of ownership groups throughout this process, some of which are no longer involved in the process. But from very early on, and more so because of some of the deadlines that you've just mentioned, our group has kind of shifted from being a funding component of an ownership bid to being a funding component for a new stadium or a larger renovation of Ralph Wilson Stadium. So in that sense, the timetables on the ownership transition really aren't that applicable to our group and our fundraising efforts. The reason for the hesitancy is you know, a couple reasons. At the league approval level, the league nowadays likes large primary investors who lead groups that are very liquid, don't need a lot of funding. And any new or novel funding stream, a lot of these ownership groups, while they're not opposed to it and they don't think the league would be opposed to it, they just don't want to take the chance of raising any red flags by introducing a novel concept into their ownership bid. So very early on, the feedback from a lot of the groups has been, We love the idea. It's one we'd love to employ if we were successful, but we think it kind of lends itself better to a stadium funding component as opposed to an ownership funding component.
Okay, and give me also a sense for the feedback you've gotten in the Bills community. You have an advisory board of some huge names, Andre Reed among others. What have you heard from former Bills?
Yeah, they've been tremendous. Andre's been one of our most vocal supporters. We also have other Hall of Famers, James Lofton, Billy Shaw, Joe DeLaMalier, Steve Christie, who's a Southern Ontario native, Phil McConkey. We also have Luke Russert is a member. And then we also have business leaders throughout Buffalo, Rochester, and Southern Ontario, and all have been great, have been very supportive, and quite frankly are the reason for all the progress we've made today.
And one more quick question from Twitter. Mary says, are we all assuming that the team definitely needs a new stadium? Can't we just stay with the renovations at the Ralph? And it sounds to me like, Brian, that message has been sent pretty clearly by the commissioner. I know fans keep coming back to it, that can't we just keep it and renovate it? And we're in the midst of renovations now, but it does sound like, realistically, it's new stadium or bust.
There has been some discord back and forth, and, you know, it's been the messaging has been heating up a little bit on both ends, both from the county executive and from the commissioner, Mr. Goodell. I think the league, you know, has a stated preference for a new stadium, while I think the county and the state would have liked to explore all options, which would be inclusive of a renovation, a more expansive renovation of Ralph Wilson Stadium. Our group doesn't take any position one way or the other. Obviously, you know, our stated goal is quite simple, just to keep the team here. In order to do that, I think we recognize that a long-term solution on the stadium issue is required. And in that regard, whether our fund goes to those renovations or goes to a new stadium, we don't really have a preference as long as it ties the team here.
So you're hearing the work of Brian Sinelli and the Buffalo Fan Alliance. Brian, the website one more time?
BuffaloFanAlliance.org.
BuffaloFanAlliance.org. Eventually they'll be trying to raise money that can be used to essentially keep the Bills in Buffalo. And it does look like it'll take a new stadium, but there's a lot to learn in the coming months. We could know a lot more in the next 8 to 10 weeks, and so we'll be following that story. Brian, thank you for taking the time on this Wednesday afternoon to join us and update us on your efforts in Buffalo.
Anytime. Thanks again for having me.
Brian Sinelli, trying to keep the Bills there. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to have a conversation with a woman who's coming to Geneva tomorrow night, Roseanne Cash, the daughter of Johnny Cash, is coming to Geneva. She's playing the Smith tomorrow night. We talk to her next on member-supported public radio.
On Tuesday, September 9th, WXXI will partner with NPR, TIAA CREF, and the University of Rochester to bring Robert Smith from Planet Money to Rochester for NPR Presents Family Matters. Robert and his guest will host an unconventional discussion in Hatch Hall about paying for college, homeownership, and retirement. Space is limited, so please reserve your seat today at our website, wxxi.org/events.
Coming up in our second hour, Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren joins me. She'll talk economic development, police reorganization, the growth of downtown, and more. It's your chance to talk to the mayor, and we'll take your questions online and on the phone. Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren coming up live in studio next hour on Connections with Evan Dawson.
Opening this week at the Little, Boyhood has broken new ground in cinema. Filmed over the course of 12 years using the same cast, you literally see the main character grow up in front of your eyes. It's amazing. It's also a great film to see as a family. Teenage kids who come to see Boyhood at the Little with their folks get in for $4. And if you'd like to chat about the film in the cafe afterwards, we just got some board games, so that's cool too. See details for Boyhood and other films at thelittle.org.
Can I change my health coverage under the Affordable Care Act?
Can I sign up for insurance through the marketplace if my employer's plan is too expensive? how do I choose a plan for my small business?
WXXI and the Innovation Trail are looking for questions about the Affordable Care Act from people like you. Log on to WXXI.org and take a brief survey about your understanding of new healthcare policies, part of a new WXXI reporting series.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. Roseanne Cash is writing music now about the South and about her life and her connection. And her new album is out. It's been out this year, and she's trying to promote it. She'll be at the Smith tomorrow night for an 8 p.m. show in Geneva. And I had a chance to talk to her this morning. Before we get to the interview, I want to play a cut from the album. So let's play a cut from the first track of Roseanne Cash's new album. Let's listen.
Stone is not a mountain, but a river runs through.
That's the song A Feather's Not a Bird from the new album The River and the Thread by Roseanne Cash. We talked about what the thread was, the thread that runs through the South, through her childhood, through her own life. And I started by asking her about her father's house. Johnny Cash grew up in a house in Dyess, Alabama, a small house that if you saw it on the side of the road, you might have no inkling that anybody famous grew up there. It is a small house on the side of the road on a very flat stretch of terrain that stretches for miles. And Roseanne Cash first went there when she was 12 years old in 1968, and that at least started her on this process, I think, of trying to understand more about her connections to all these places in the South.
Certainly a seed of understanding about my own history and my family's history was born then, but as a, 12-year-old, I didn't quite take it in, the meaning. But, flash forward to the present, and I started going down to work with Arkansas State University to restore that house, which, by the way, the grand opening was last Saturday, and I went down for this incredible dedication. But that sparked this inspiration, but also the death of Marshall Grant, who was like a surrogate father to me after my dad died, and he was in the original Tennessee too with my dad starting in 55. And at the same time, we happened to be taking a lot of trips to the Delta and Appalachia. I have a friend in Alabama who was teaching me to sew, and it was a perfect storm of inspiration for these songs about the South. And my husband, John Leventhal, and I wrote the whole album together, so it was a true collaboration, which was also another part of the, layers of connection in this project.
Yeah, you took it upon yourself with your husband to go see many of the viscerally important places in the South. How did you decide, for example, what landmarks and what places you wanted to visit?
It was part on instinct. John is a native New Yorker and who loves roots music more than any New Yorker I know or could think of. And he had always wanted to drive down Highway 61. So we did that for his birthday one year. And we took these side trips into Mississippi to see these places that are so important to roots musicians, Robert Johnson's grave and Dockery Farms, where all the great blues musicians sat in the juke joint and played. And John also happens to be a William Faulkner fan, so we went to Faulkner's house. So there was, we just accomplished a lot of little dreams on these trips to visit these really important. But we followed the blues trail through Natchez, Mississippi. It was fantastic.
You went to the Tallahatchie Bridge as well.
Yes.
And in a way, you said on CBS Sunday Morning, you almost felt like you manufactured a moment by pulling your guitars out and sitting on that bridge. But the result the result is a song that doesn't sound manufactured at all. It sounds aching and real and, somehow part of you or part of the culture there.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, we didn't realize the proximity of these places. Robert Johnson's grave to the Tallahatchie Bridge, to Money, Mississippi, which, the murder of Emmett Till in 1955 eventually sparked the civil rights movement. All of these places were, you could walk between them practically. And that was mind-blowing. And you're right, the song that came out of visiting the Tallahatchie Bridge and Robert Johnson's grave and Money, Mississippi, Money Road is haunted, because these places seem haunted, and you take it with you.
And in a sense, there's an interesting juxtaposition in that you look at the house and dais that is now being sort of landmarked and commemorated, but in many ways, the places you visited for this album, Tallahatchie Bridge first among them, if you don't know the history, you might not know it, because they don't necessarily stand out or aren't marked in a way that is obvious, and that feels strange. That feels, it's almost amazing that you and John can grab your guitars and go sit on that bridge and play, given the history there. Was it strange in some ways to you to be at these places, and if you don't know, you might not know?
You know, it was odd, and it was kind of a relief, you know, that you could still visit these places and touch them so viscerally and feel like you were time traveling, that it was exactly the same. And yet, at the same time, you say, well, people should know about Money, Mississippi and the Tallahatchie Bridge and the father of the blues, and certainly people seek those places out who know about them, but it's not as if they are souvenir stands everywhere, which, like I said, is a relief.
We're talking to Roseanne Cash, whose new album is called The River and the Thread. She plays Thursday night at the Smith Opera House in Geneva at 8 p.m. Your song, A Feather's Not a Bird, touches on the part of the journey back to Memphis and to Arkansas. And I'd love to know how you would describe the meaning of the words, A Feather's Not a Bird.
Well, I hate to take away your own interpretation. That's always a danger for a songwriter, to give you a pat answer, because part of the mystery is what you think about it. But to me, it means that even though the part isn't the whole, there is still this profound river of connection between each of us and something bigger than us. And that song, A Feather's Not a Bird, it lays out the landscape for the whole record, you know, going from my dear friend in Alabama who taught me to sew and actually said that line. She said, you have to love the thread. And she wasn't speaking in metaphors, but I took it that way. All the way through Mississippi and Memphis and Arkansas to my dad's, the place he grew up, that part of the New Deal era colony, which was, you know, even you can't even take it out of the context of the New Deal, because that's a huge part of American history too. So all of those touchstones along the way were laid out in that song.
When people hear the name Cash, they might assume that you're not only a child of the South, but you've always been in the South. And mm-hmm. you spent years of your childhood in California and now New York City. So is this new album your way of kind of going back over your DNA, you know, and in a way retracing parts of you that you haven't been close to in a while? How would you describe it?
That is true. You know, in middle age, you want to know who you're connected to, where you come from. I also wanted to find these things out for my children as well as myself. I want them to know who they're connected to. But I can't separate this or divorce it from the music, because it's also a musical statement and reconnection. And all of these forms of Southern music, you know, blues, country pop, roots, Appalachian, those are all deeply embedded in what John and I do. So it's not as if it were a novel. I mean, there is a landscape in it, and there's a lot of geography, but it's also a musical statement as much as a literary one.
When I listen to the album, for me, it not only is a pleasurable listen, but it's a meaningful one. It makes me want to travel. It makes me want to see some of these places. And so when most people travel to the Tallahatchie Bridges of the world and the landmarks that you write about, we're not going to produce an award-winning album, but at the same time, it could impact us. Even if we grew up you know, outside of the South, would you recommend that we all sort of seek out these important landmarks, no matter what the purpose or our background is?
If that's what your impulse is. I mean, I don't think when you're young that it's important, but, you know, at some point, like I said, in midlife, a lot of people, I've heard this, that they want to know what their, I mean, a lot of people say to me, oh, this makes me want to go to the South. I want to see these places. But other people say, this makes me want to find what I'm connected to, which is a beautiful thing. You know, and these things I thought were anecdotal in my life, the fact that I was born in Memphis, that, you know, two generations back my family were cotton farmers, they're not anecdotal. I found that this, like you said, this is part of DNA, both musical and literal.
We're talking to Roseanne Cash, coming to the Smith Opera House in Geneva, 8 p.m. Thursday night, and touring, promoting the new album, The River and the Thread. It is a wonderful listen. Before we let you go, a couple of interesting quick points. First of all, you're not a stranger to collaboration, but there's a lot of collaboration on this album. From some classic names to some younger names in the business, the Civil Wars, for example. You know, give me a sense for your desire to reach out and bring so many other interesting people in.
Well, I love collaboration, and it seems the older I get, the more I love collaboration. And like I said, John and I wrote all these songs together, so someone even said to me, wow, this record's the sound of a marriage, you know, words and music, which is a very romantic collaboration. But John Paul White of the Civil Wars, and then my old friend Chris Christopherson, John Prine, Tony Joe White, Amy Helm, and Corey Chisel, who's one of the greatest blue-eyed soul singers around. They're just Allison Moore. There's some great voices on this record, and it felt like, even in that level, and Rodney Crowell, my ex-husband. You know, so all of these old and new connections were very enriching.
And so much of it comes from your marriage. I think that's very interesting that someone said it sounds like a marriage. There are plenty of marriages, Roseanne, that really can't stand to work together, that they need that separation. And you've obviously proven that not only can you do it, but you can do it to remarkable success. Can you share every song? Every song is different. Every origin of every song is different. But can you share maybe an example from the album of how the song is created, how you work with your husband, and what the process is like?
Sure, but, you know, it's not all roses. We fight plenty of times in the studio or about musical things, but I think we've learned to fight in a good way about it. In the beginning, we used to bring everything personal to the studio, and you hurt my feelings because you don't like that note I sang. But now, when we're arguing, it's in service of what we're doing, which is a big difference. Every song has its own genesis in the way it plays out. Sometimes I would write a piece of a lyric, I give it to him, and he writes a melody, and then I finish it. Some songs, like Night School, I wrote the entire lyric and gave it to him. And some of it, he wrote a piece of a melody, and then I started from there. So each song is different. If you could predict how a song was going to come into being, it wouldn't be songwriting. It would be something else. But there was a lot of conversation, you know, and some re-recording, like it wasn't quite right. Money Row, the song you mentioned, he rewrote the music to that 3 times, and I was still fine-tuning the lyrics in the studio. That one was a difficult one to create, and some of them seemed to drop in your lap. They required editing, but they came, you know, almost fully formed, which is a beautiful thing, and you're lucky if that happens. But the whole process, I wouldn't say it was easy, but both of us think it's the most satisfying work we've ever done. And it feels good at my age. I mean, it's really moving to me that I'm not burnt out. I love what I do as much as I did when I was 20. And I still feel I'm doing good work. And that is, I just feel so lucky that that's how it is in my life right now.
Once in a while, we talk to an artist, and I've said before, it's one thing to say, boy, I really enjoy your work. It's another to say, I really feel like your work is important. And that's how I felt about this album. It's beautiful, it's meaningful, and congratulations on not only the album, but welcome once again to Geneva tomorrow, I should say Thursday night, and everyone's excited to see you here. So thank you for taking the time for us today.
Well, Evan, thank you so much, and I really take in what you said and appreciate that, and I look forward to getting up to your neck of the woods.